So it's I mean, I know you, that's not what we're here to,
no.
we're not here to talk about, but I just think that sometimes identity politics is an important step for people to recognize that they aren't alone as an individual, that there are other people that share their experiences in similar ways because of the social, larger social relations that we live in. It's not like if you're Black living in Chicago, it's your fault that you don't have a job or you don't have income or you don't own your own home. It's because we live in a society that redlines, that discriminates in education, that doesn't have money to have a decent education, that doesn't have public support for transportation or other things that would allow you to break out of that. So it's not your fault. But to recognize that because you are Black and there's other people that are Black and you face conditions of racism and discrimination because you are Black is an important first step. There was a Harvard poll just this year that showed that the majority of millennials, the 20-somethings, the majority of them are more in favor of socialism than capitalism, and that's the first time it's happened since they've been doing polls. I don't think that's because they've taken more classes or read up on Karl Marx. I think it's because their experience is such that even when they work hard, when they go to school and get their student loans, there still isn't any opportunity. At the same time, they see CEOs and lobbyists and corporations being treated as individuals, and there's an increased recognition that there is a class difference. And I don't think you always necessarily need the vocabulary that explains it as the capitalist class and the working class. I think that's sharp and I think it's important, but the initial understanding is more an increased awareness of what your daily life looks like. So you work your life and you are laid off right before you get your pension, or you work your full life and your kids are going to school to get in debt for a college education when there isn't a guaranteed job out the other end. That begins to see this disparity, and it gets expressed real shorthand with the 1%, like in Occupy, or it can even be expressed in the Trump campaign where they talk about the corporate raiders or the people that want to use trade to steal jobs. So it even gets in a distorted way, it's recognized across the political spectrum. It doesn't get articulated that way, which is the problem.
Literature, people sharing their stories?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think at the same time, popular culture is one of the primary ways that it gets disguised, because criticisms, challenges are communicated through popular culture. But then, because popular culture isn't democratic, isn't really under our control, but it's also controlled by a culture industry, that challenge, that critique, gets reworked into a further support for the inequality of the system. I give you an example from Disney animated features. There are more characters that are Black. There are more characters that are Hispanic. There are more characters, female characters, that aren't the traditional feminine Cinderella type, but they are stronger, they are fully clad, they may not be in that same shape. But in that process, the Disney story recreates preference and acceptance and defense of a hierarchy. Almost every Disney animated feature reinforces some form of royalty or hierarchy, whether that's from Zootopia, which has an authority system in place, and there's this unequal difference between the predators and the prey, or even Frozen, which is presented as a feminist Disney film because the woman doesn't fall in love and marry the handsome man. But the story itself is a reinforcement of the hierarchy such that the princess can freeze the entire population when she's mad, and that's just part of the story. But that's an expression of the privilege that a very small elite has. I would argue in much of rap, it's that way too. Well, there may be a resistance to police brutality, or there may be a recognition that there's racism. Much of rap also reinforces, I'm going to get as much money as I can. I'm going to live in the mansion that I want to live in. I want to have the car and the women that will make me successful. So it's a very limited explanation of how to be
commercial, successful.
Rap that may come from, they're gone now, but Public Enemy or something like that, which was more political, is not promoted by the record industry, is not promoted by radio, is not right? It's there, yes.
You have to go to university stations or
an independent label.
You spoke about the princess freezing the planet. Good segue into Hillary Clinton, the threat of nuclear war.
I think there still remains a division within the American capitalist class. A big part of the American capitalist class would be interested in having more of a transnational, peaceful operation where they could produce and make profits anywhere, right? Whether it's France or China or Syria. There are some obstacles to that, and part of it is there continues to be competition between industries from one country to another or within one country. But one thing they all agree upon, whether they're British or French or German or the U.S. or the Turkish for that matter, is that there has to be some way of assuring their successful control over the production or the exploitation of resources, either of those. And that means they need an armed force because they aren't always able of winning consent anywhere and always. In the U.S., the consent is largely based upon the fact that we have for much of America, a relatively sustainable way of life. People have incomes. They aren't starving to death, although there is hunger. It's relatively speaking, there is reason to say, well, this has been good for us. And in some of the Western countries, I think that's true also. In some of the countries in Latin America or Africa or Asia, the expectation that will happen if they adopt a free market or adopt increased production for the world market means that there's been sections of those societies that have had a dramatic increase in their well-being. So you have a rising middle class in Brazil or a rising middle class in China. While you have that, you have a smaller elite, like there's a million millionaires in China now. And there's millions of middle-class people, but there's hundreds of millions of people that are struggling for hourly wages or don't even have that as a regular thing. So you have this, you have what appears in the media on the surface, this support for free trade or the support for a neoliberal regime of you break down all the barriers and everybody will be happy. And the sources for that and the coverage of that is this layer that has had some modest success. What's missing is the overwhelming majority of humanity, which has not benefited from that, continues to do the work, continues to live in terrible conditions of nutrition and environment
insecurity
and the list goes on. But that's just not part of the media presentation, and which is why I think it plays out so much when we look at a place like Syria or Yemen or Iraq or Afghanistan. That story or that understanding just does not appear in the media. It's reduced to something like a religious fanaticism or a cultural difference or Muslims and Arabs. Or in Latin America, it would be reduced to indigenous peoples that somehow need to be enlightened by Western educated elites in Ecuador as opposed to the indigenous population in Ecuador deciding what they want to do with their resources.
This is a part of the hegemony of ideology.
I understand hegemony with a slight variation of that. I don't think it's simply domination by the U.S. or by the U.S. media. I see it more as a concerted effort to win consent for that way of life, and that consent is won.
It's often imposed.
Well, when you can't win consent, then you have to rely upon some coercive force. But it's much more effective if you can win consent because then you don't have to police. It's more efficient because people internalize it and socialize it, and everybody's
struggling in their culture.
The culture has to be beneficial for that population or marginally beneficial or give the appearance that it soon will be beneficial. Maybe not today, but if I keep doing this, I will come out the other end. Kind of like in the U.S. education system. Why do I have to take these tests in 10th grade? Well, so you can get into AP English. Well, why do I want to do that? Well, so you can get into a college and already have credits. Well, how do I get into college? Well, you borrow money. Why would I borrow money? Because when you get your degree, you're going to have this job. Well, when you get this job, why don't I have any benefits? Well, you have to work harder. So it's always slightly down the road, But with the media giving us images every night on TV, or when we go to the movies, or when you read the newspaper, even though it may not be true for me, there's this appearance that it's true for some. If I just keep fighting and struggling, and to the extent that that's reasonable, people will consent to it. But when that contradiction becomes so big, then you've got a problem of leadership, and they usually show up with some coercive force. Ferguson or Laquan McDonald is an example. Blacks, and I would say the majority of the population, probably knew the police used physical force in the black community or the Hispanic community. It did not break that support until it became so dramatic with the shooting of unarmed men, shooting of men that are leaving the police, choking of men on the street that are trying to be arrested. That breaks the consent, because there is suddenly an image that makes it much clearer, and that consent is broken. The consent that people have had, even me, as being a machinist, because you had a job, because there was security, you could rely upon that, you could plan for the future. When you lay off two-thirds of the steel industry, or you lay off half of the people that work in the auto plants, consent for that system disappears. And you need some other way of filling that in. You could fill it in with some racist claim, or you can fill it in with some coercive frame. Or you have a war, then you look for a different enemy. But the war is also
I would not
want to think that they went to war just for that reason. There's also reasons to go to war to stop any democratic movement that happens in any other country. I mean, it was a shock to the American government when in Egypt a military dictatorship was overthrown by a democratic social movement of millions of Egyptians, which also happened in Tunis. When it got to Bahrain, we're on the edge of that. The U.S. intervened with support for Bahrain. When it goes to another country, the U.S. says, okay, enough. They don't say that publicly. The media doesn't say that. They will always talk about democracy, but it's a particular version of democracy that doesn't allow democratic participation by the population. So if that continues to happen, the argument that you can only have two parties in the U.S. and that's democracy, when there are other countries where they actually have more participation in democracy and people can actually write their constitution and decide how they want to produce things, and they don't need a king, they don't need a dictator, they don't need military police, that's a threat. And that would be a reason to intervene. And then when you add on top of that the possibility that the oil or natural gas or other resources won't be readily available.
Like in Venezuela.
And the same thing's true in Ecuador and Bolivia when we're talking about natural gas. The resource and the value that's created, a large share of that goes to the Venezuelan, Bolivian, Ecuadorian people. Less of it goes to Exxon, British Petroleum, or Total, the French, right? And that means they don't make the same kind of profit that they used to make, which threatens their way of survival. It gets even increasingly that way if we're talking about the Mideast, because as far as the oil industry or the natural gas industry, or for that matter, most of the productive industries care, the systems that have been in existence since World War II in the Mideast have been very authoritarian, very military, very coercive, very undemocratic, but they've been very stable for investing and exploitation of resources and trade, let alone, I can't imagine what the profits are to the military industry that sells arms to Saudi Arabia, to Egypt, to Israel, to Turkey. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars every year. So yeah, there's lots of reasons beyond just distracting the American people from problems. I think it's more, there is a contradiction in capitalism that cannot be overcome. And it's that profits are based upon the labor that we put into creating value. So we create value, but we don't get paid for that value. We get paid a wage. Part of that value is taken as a profit. But for that value to be realized, it has to be sold. If General Motors makes cars and they sit on the lot, General Motors makes no money. They have to sell the cars. The contradiction is the people that produce the cars or the people that don't produce the cars don't make enough money to buy all the cars that are produced. And this is true for every product. Don't make enough money to buy all the beer. Don't make enough money to buy all the gasoline. It's a crisis of overproduction on a world scale. And that is something that the capitalists can never overcome. And the way that they've overcome it in the past is destroy things, because if you just destroy things, they've got to be produced again. And that's usually meant destroying the smaller industries, just driving them out of business. On a larger scale, you have a war and you can destroy another country. Now, they need everything. They need buildings, they need furniture, they need beds, they need refrigerators. Everything that was destroyed has to be replaced. So that's economically beneficial. But you have to think about that bizarre contradiction. You have to destroy everything in order to raise your gross national product. That's just it's a backward system, and it's a contradictory system. No matter how much they do to lower wages or how much they do to raise profits, this contradiction on a world scale exists. We don't make enough money to buy the stuff that we produce, which creates a crisis for the capitalist class. You end up in recession, you end up in depression, you end up with overproduction, and then there's a scramble on how to get out of it. And usually it's in a form of austerity, cut back more on the general population, reduce the amount of money that comes from industry for the public good, for social welfare, increase the taxes on the general population. But again, that creates a social crisis. People respond, like in Greece or Spain or in Venezuela or Brazil. Well, as long as if we look at the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank or some of the other transnational agencies, as long as the rules for investment, the rules for development, the plans for that are done through the free market and based upon market relations, it means everything that's done puts whether or not a profit can be made as its priority, as opposed to whether or not the planet will survive or whether or not it's best for society, right? Clean air would be best for society. Healthy air would be best for us. But it's not cost effective. So you don't, if you're worried about your costs, you allow dirty air to exist. And if people die in the process from a cost benefit analysis, it doesn't really affect the bottom line of any particular company. And the governments are left to deal with it. And it's dealt with. If you thought it, again, in a very peculiar way, you could argue the less healthy the American people are, the better it is for the GNP. The more unsafe our cars are, the better it is for the GNP. Well, how could that be? Because if you're not healthy, you need more medicine, you need more doctors, you need to go to the hospital, so all those things have to be produced. But if you were healthy, none of that would be necessary. Cars, every car that gets destroyed, right? Well, you got to build a new one. For everybody that's injured in that, well, they have to go to the hospital. So everything that's really destructive from a human point of view is very profitable from a GNP point of view. And as long as the global trade system uses that as its primary marker, those contradictions and those consequences will get worse. What I am most hopeful of, and I think if people get outside of their own immediate existence, I think more people in the world would be hopeful, is that there is an increasing recognition by millions of people everywhere on the planet and asking for and working towards and creating a different social system. So, right, just in the last 20 or 30 years, apartheid's been removed from South Africa. All of the military dictatorships have been removed from Latin America, except maybe Colombia. Right, we've had social movements in Greece and Spain. There was the what that was called the Arab Spring, where military governments were overthrown. We have the progress that's been shown in Bolivia and Ecuador and Venezuela. Now, they haven't all been successful. They haven't all been perfect. But it does show that humans, our fellow humans, are able to recognize that a system based on private profits is irrational and dangerous and threatening not only to human life, but to life on the planet. And they are experimenting with and instituting new social relations so production is done for the common good. So if we need more milk, we will have more dairy cows. If we need more transportation, we will build sustainable mass transit that doesn't pollute the air to get people there, even if it costs, because the cost is kind of irrelevant to our existence.
Countries that do that find themselves under attack.
And NATO and the U.S.
And yeah, their long-term plan.
Yes, which is why they go haywire when something like Mercosur or ALBA, the bank that Venezuela had, where they were making fair and equitable trade between Venezuela, Cuba, even Brazil, Ecuador was in, Argentina was in, so with China, but about a new economic relationship among Latin American countries that wasn't based primarily on securing profits for Latin American industry, it was primarily on making trade so that would benefit the populations of those countries.
It wasn't dependent on the World Bank.
Yes, and that drove them crazy, which is, I would argue, one reason why there was the concerted effort to have the parliamentary coup against Rousseff in Brazil, and the kind of interventions that have been done in Paraguay and that are currently going on in Venezuela, because the last thing you want is to have a different system that is rational, that meets people's needs, that isn't based upon that market system. Because the mantra now is, what's the bottom line? How much does it cost? Can we afford to do this? Which all pushes us back towards the market. When we recognize that it doesn't have to be that way, that it actually can be successful in another way, that argument completely falls. So if you can't convince people or you can't win consent, then you have to turn to more coercive measures, which means direct intervention like bombing Syria, or direct intervention like aiding Saudi Arabia to bomb Yemen, or indirect intervention like providing funds and resources to Latin America, to the what they call the democratic opposition. But that's financed by the U.S. openly. It's not like it's a secret or a conspiracy.
Yeah.
They openly finance the efforts for democracy or humanitarian intervention in different places in the world, which is, it's Orwellian in the sense that it's just the opposite of the labels that they've been given. And the interesting thing is, the candidates that are running for office, Clinton, for example, says, yes, when I'm elected, there will be a no-fly zone. I understand there will be a confrontation with Russia, but we have to be more assertive in establishing NATO and the U.S. rights. So if that means confrontation with Russia, she's looking forward to it. And that's their, that's almost joyful in the way that they proceed, which is very frightening when you think about what's on the immediate horizon.
The language has been undermined and repurposed.
Absolutely. I think that the language is an element of being human. I would argue the fact that we can create our own world is what makes us primarily human. But in that process, creating language to exchange meaning is absolutely essential. But we also know that language can help us clarify and improve understanding, or language can be used to obfuscate and hide understanding. So it kind of depends on how we want to use language. If you are in a program where you're going to try to convince somebody to do something that's not in their best interest, you're going to use the best language you can to disguise that or to misrepresent that. And I would argue much of the rhetoric coming out of Washington about the war in Syria is of that nature. It's to obscure and disguise the actual policies. You've hit the nail on the head with humanitarian intervention. I would argue that your listeners should always be nervous whenever a politician says they want to have a humanitarian intervention anywhere, because it's probably not true. It's probably the excuse for some increase in violence, increase in a military intervention. And right now, listeners can watch this real time. Watch the coverage in the Chicago Tribune or on the nightly network news or in the New York Times. Watch the coverage of the U.S.-supported Iraq attack on Mosul and compare it with the nightly news and the Tribune and the New York Times coverage of the Aleppo situation. The same actions, how are they described in the news? The exact same actions by either a government force or an opposition force, and an opposition force in one case, in the case of Mosul, is said to be using civilians as a human shield. In the other case, where there's evidence to show that ISIS, which is also in Aleppo, and Al-Qaeda in Aleppo, and al-Nusra, which now has another name, actually did not allow civilians to leave a week ago when there was a corridor allowed, they had armed fighters in the corridor that were shooting civilians so they couldn't leave. That's not presented. It's presented as if Russia and Syria are bombing civilians. But in Mosul, and they're kind of preparing us for this. The media and the State Department is preparing us for this. There will be thousands, if not tens of thousands, people killed, including children, in the retaking of Mosul. Right. But it will be justified as a necessary consequence of taking Mosul back from ISIS. In the case of Aleppo, it will never be justified to take Aleppo back from ISIS, because Aleppo would be taken back by Syria, which the U.S. does not support, whereas the Iraqi government, the U.S. is in alliance with. And again, you don't have to have my perspective. Any citizen, anybody that reads or watches the news, can make these same judgments. And it's clear, it's obvious, the way it's being framed. And they frame it by, you're right, with the language. One is a humanitarian intervention. One is abusive, one is necessary, one is collateral damage, one will be indiscriminating violence, right? And in that process, the terms are decided before by whether or not the U.S. State Department has decided the party that they're in favor of will be treated that way, and the media accordingly will cover them in that way. It's unfortunate because it's like, how do you know because you're not there? Well, one of the ways you can know is by reading how they describe it. Where are they reporting from? Who are they quoting? How are they describing the people they are quoting? And what is the larger frame that they are putting on whatever the event is? Is the larger frame a humanitarian intervention? I could almost guarantee that there will be no cry for humanitarian intervention as the Iraqi, backed by U.S. Special Forces, goes into Mosul and people are dying. There will not be a cry for humanitarian intervention because the U.S. is already there. But there will be a claim that ISIS is responsible for all of the deaths. The blood is on their hands. That's the way it will be presented. And it's very seldom we have an opportunity to compare two media framings of events that are so close geographically time-wise that can really reveal how this is done. And anybody that wants to can test it. And I would encourage them, if they find something different, please let me know. The no-fly zone is not necessarily humanitarian because obviously people will continue to die. But the point that you're making is, yes, that no-fly zone would be a safe operating zone for the forces that the U.S. have decided is part of the democratic opposition, which ironically is largely the Free Syrian Army, which, again, ironically or not, is part of the Syrian military. There, they just want a different Assad. It's like they didn't care if it was a Hussein regime. They wanted a different Hussein. So if Syria defend Assad, but you're right, it's a secular government, and it's been a fairly modernized society with industry. Right. But the more important thing to me is not whether Assad was brutal or not brutal. The question is, at what point did whatever brutality you might assign to him become unacceptable to the U.S.? And that only comes at the point where he is an obstacle to U.S. larger geopolitical intentions in the region. And you're right, with the Ba'ath Party and the refusal to be explicit support of Israel, opposed to the one of the pipelines that they had planned to go from the Gulf to Europe, which would pass through Syria, and he wasn't in favor of, refusal to completely disavow any connection with Iran. And even though oftentimes that was rhetoric for Assad to maintain his position, just like rhetoric of our government against the American people is not always full-throated and honest. Assad was not either. My only point is that the U.S. could live with that until it became an obstacle to their larger geopolitical goals, just like they lived with Hussein until he became an obstacle to their larger political goals.
And Gaddafi.
And Gaddafi, yes. Maybe less with Gaddafi, because Gaddafi probably was much more active in terms of his support and his active spread of his form of Libyan socialism. But the other point I think we should make for people that want to say there needs to be a no-fly zone, I spoke with a Syrian after that panel in Loyola, and I said, just think, what was the outcome of the no-fly zone in Iraq? How did that benefit the Iraqi people? We have an experience of what a U.S.-imposed no-fly zone looks like. Right, 500,000 children starved to death, and Madeleine Albright said that was okay, that was worth the price. Clinton has already said, yes, a no-fly zone and a more muscular U.S. presence will mean more people die. They've already said that. So to think the no-fly zone is going to mean less casualties is just, it's not going to happen. There will be more casualties, and the problem will be is, actually, in the longer run, there will probably be increased violence because it will allow the continued operation of those groups that are armed and financed either by the U.S. directly or by Saudis or Qataris indirectly, that will continue the fighting and the killing in Syria and, for that matter, in Iraq and Turkey. The only operative thing is the U.S. needs to withdraw itself from Syria. There needs to be a complete boycott of any arms trade to the region. No more armaments from anybody to anybody. And the U.S. should be hands off Syria. Let the Syrians decide in a free and open society. And I think that's where they were headed. They had mass demonstrations. They were growing in momentum. Assad did brutally repress those, but so did Mubarak in Egypt, and that didn't work out well. What happened in Syria is when Assad resisted the democratic movement, U.S. and Saudi intervened to arm a section, and they saw an opportunity which basically subverted that mass democratic, potentially even peaceful, if that's significant, but that was undermined by this intervention of U.S. and Saudis to arm a section that immediately undercut any authority or any ability of the democratic opposition had to build itself. On the level of the journalists, they don't see it that way. On the level of the journalists, just like the level of the American people, they probably honestly feel that there needs to be a humanitarian intervention in Syria because they can see the suffering. The second reason is the structure of the media industry in this country in particular is highly concentrated, consolidated, and they are there to make a profit, which means you have fewer positions for investigative reporting. So there isn't any long-term investigation of any event, even of an ongoing war like Syria. There is an immediate requirement that you submit a story by tomorrow morning. And you have to have your 8 column inches, and where are you going to get a good quote, and who knows what's going on, who's legitimately knowing? The State Department, the Pentagon, the White House. What about the opposition? Well, how do you contact an opposition? Or if you did contact an opposition, the fear would be that you were being unpatriotic by interviewing Assad or a Syrian government representative. And then on top of that, there is an understanding by the actual owners of the media that they have a vested interest in the same outcome of events that the steel industry, the auto industry, the oil industry is. The media industry has the same interests because they also rely upon a consumer society, a heavily authoritarian, heavy society, because that's part of the structure of how they produce and profit from the media that they make. So ideologically and socially, they have they're simpatico. And then as you move down the ladder, the editors and the publishers accept the claims that we've all been socialized to in school about the U.S. being a great force for good. If you look at the U.S. Navy TV ad, and that's what our civics and history and political science classes teach us. So it's kind of a self-perpetuating operation. I don't think it's so sinister. I think it's more part of the structure of the industry and the structure of our culture. But I don't think it's something that's insurmountable. I think when it is contradicted by life on the ground, it all collapses quickly, which happened with Vietnam, for instance. I had friends that came back and they gave a different story. I had friends that would write me a letter, right? You're drafting the American youth and they don't want to go, and they go and they find it. We have a volunteer army, one. Second, there's an increased move to technology, which further distances us from the death and destruction. So the reporters that get embedded don't see that, number one. Number two, they're embedded with a group that they identify with very quickly, a psychological commitment. These are the troops that are protecting them. So their perspective is a very narrow perspective. You put all of these things together, it would be surprising to me if our media didn't do this. It would be, you know, it would be like something out of the Magic Kingdom. It has to be like this because of the way it's owned, the way it's organized, the way the news media is financed and funded, the fact that it's an industry attracting viewers to be sold to advertisers, that you rely upon a very narrow, limited number of sources, that you don't have access to other sources. That whole thing means this is what you would expect. And I would say, I've done some studies on this. This is what the French saw when France bombed Mali. This is what the British saw when the British bombed the Falklands. This is, right? You could go down the list. And what the Chinese are probably seeing now as they build those little islands. Part of it is, I would say, not all media have that position. We can find differences within the media in the U.S. where they aren't quite so enthusiastically anti-Russia. They may be anti-Putin. Secondly, when you look on a world scale, the commercial media is not like that at all. In fact, the European media is very reluctant to raise the ante against the Soviet Union, in part because the numbers close to 40% of German exports go to Russia, and Russia's primary trading partner is Germany. So the idea that that would go away is not real attractive to them. Secondly, I would say sometimes the politicians in office, there's not a one-to-one correspondence to what they say and who they represent. So you have a very right-wing Tea Party Republicans. You have liberal Democrats like Bernie Sanders. They're all part of these two parties. But there's differences among the politicians who are vying for their own self-interest for re-election committees, benefits of lobbying money and the rest. And that doesn't always express what's in the best interest. Well, it never expresses the best interests of the American people. And it does not always express the interests of the major industries in this country.
Why are you concerned that we may end up in a nuclear war?
Clinton has the backing of the largest sections of the capitalist class in this country. She has the backing of the military and the Pentagon and all of the political advisors, and her stated and repeated and emphasized policy is to institute a no-fly zone and stop Putin from his expansion, which is another one of those words. I would argue there has been no expansion. In fact, it's been a NATO expansion. This is one of her campaign promises I think will be delivered on, because it's part of what Obama has done. It's what Bush did before him. It's what Clinton did before him. And that, to me, is the fear. And it's like I said, there sections of the capitalist class would like a transnational nice system where they could have a factory almost anywhere, have people work for low wages and make a lot of profit. At the same time, that doesn't happen, and there's still these national differences, and sometime to make that happen, you have to rely upon a one nation state to get that done. So to get U.S. investment in India, the Indian nation state has to pass the laws that allow U.S. investment. U.S. investors would be advocating for that and appear to be nationalist Americans when what they're after is opportunities for American companies to merge with Indian companies. But to express that to the American people, it can't be expressed that way. They have to use the rhetoric of American nationalism.
So Russia went through an experience where they saw American capitalism up close, and it caused a decline in the life expectancy of the Russian male.
Yes, and again, but I would argue the Russian capitalists don't care about that any more than the American capitalists care about life expectancy for the U.S. Russia is a capitalist country. Russia wants to invest and make profits too. The U.S. would like to invest in Russia, but just as the U.S. would like to invest in France, and the U.S. is really irritated with France, like the beef industry would like the French control of genetically modified organisms in their food to go away. And the U.S. has gone to the World Court, and they've gone to the IMF, and they've challenged French national laws. So the U.S. is very, in that sense, arguably nationalistic. But really what they want is the barriers to their investment, the barriers to their merger with French companies to go away. The French companies and the French politicians are somewhat fearful of that. They would prefer to have a merger, but they want the merger to be to their benefit. So whoever the French investments...
The population who says, we want to eat, but we want to eat within our culture, we don't want to harm our bodies...
The same thing is true, I would argue.
We'd like to stay human, is what they're saying.
Well, yeah, but you can...
You consumers in a production system.
Yeah, that would be the most positive read on it. I would say it's also partly that the French media and film industry realizes they can't compete on an international scale because people don't speak French, so that one of the ways they protect their industry is to have national restrictions. It's like China has restrictions on the number of foreign films. Why? Because they aren't yet capable of producing enough films for all of their theaters, and they would be inundated with European and U.S. films. So now they have a rule. You can still see U.S. films there, but they are joint ventures. So Shanghai Media Group has a joint venture with Warner to produce a film that's a Chinese film.
Otherwise, you end up with a monopoly controlled by Western capital and Western culture.
Right, but what I'm suggesting is we will end up with a monopoly in the media industry. You just won't be able to say it's Western or American. Mm-hmm. It will be a monopoly that's a monopoly of the film industry that is a combination of Chinese, American, French, British. There will still be a capitalist monopoly. The nationality gets layered over it because it's the way that you express it to the American people or to the French people, the Chinese people, because you don't want them thinking about class differences because you can't mobilize them that way. But you can mobilize them around national differences, even though that's a subversion of what the actual interest is of the American capitalist class to get films in China. General Motors right now makes more cars, produces and sells more cars in China than in the U.S. So General Motors does not want the U.S. to defeat China. They're making hundreds of millions of dollars. They want China to open its barriers to more U.S. investment. The largest theater owner in the United States is China. They Walden Media Group owns AMC movie. When people go to theater tonight in Michigan City, Indiana, they're going to go to a theater that's owned by the Chinese. But so China doesn't want the U.S. to be defeated. But for each of their own reasons, they use the national identity to mobilize the American people or the Chinese people in whatever calculus they have to improve the opportunities for investments for both of these industries, whether they're media or, in the case of the Mideast, oil industry. But it's not primarily to protect American interests. It's primarily to protect and to take advantage of American industry interests, whether that's media or oil or transportation or the arms industry.
Thank you very much, Professor Arts.
Thank you. I'm happy to be with you. I'd be interested in hearing what your listeners have to say. So if you'd like to put them in touch with me or give me an email at artz@pnw.edu. That's my university email, and I'll be happy to see what they have to say.
Okay.